Welcome to Worlds Apart. One of the most celebrated generals in human history, Sun Tzu, implored his followers to know the enemy and try to subdue it without fighting. His seminal work, The Art of War, is still part of the curricula in many military academies around the world, and yet the number and the scale of conflicts is on the increase. Is it even possible to retire war as a means of politics? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by B.K. Sharma, Major General of the Indian Armed Forces and Director of the United Service Institution of India. Major General, it's great pleasure and great honor for me to join you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, in your analysis of the conflict in Ukraine, you often make the point that the West wasn't able to clearly see what was Russia's threat perceptions. Are you sure it was due to the lack of understanding or, on the contrary, a clear realization of what was at stake there for Russia and Ukraine and a very deliberate, very conscious decision to ignore Russia's security concerns?
Yes, of course. There is no denying the fact that Russia has been defining its red lines very clearly. It also articulated its national security concerns. And the most important of those was that this former Soviet Union state should not be incorporated in NATO because NATO is already 300 miles away from St. Petersburg. So for whatever reason, the West actually stepped over those red lines. Similarly, there was also no follow-up on the Minsk Accord 2014, 2015, and subsequently, what happened at West was helping Ukraine to build up its military capability. And there was a kind of a perception in Russia that there could be a preemptive strike on Donbas region and Crimea. And therefore, I think it was a Hobson choice for Russia to take this preemptive, what you call as the military entry into Ukraine.
I would love to discuss the logic of that decision and the rationale of that decision with you. But before we go there, let me ask you specifically about the expansion of NATO, because I read somewhere that Condoleezza Rice back in 2008 at the Bucharest summit, where Ukraine's intention to join the alliance was formally welcomed for the first time, that Condoleezza Rice stated explicitly there that the Cold War was over and Russia needed to accept that it lost. Do you think this drive to expand NATO, was it primarily motivated by strategic and security considerations in the West, or was it simply about psychology to sort of force Russia into submission and recognition of its losing status? Was it about security or psychology, to put it simply?
I think it was hubris on American part. They became overconfident after the breakup of the Soviet Union, and probably because of historical animosities, they wanted to create more dilemmas for Russia. And that is why, post the breakup of Soviet Union, George Kennan was very, I think, erudite, and he was prescient when he said that the new Cold War has begun. Then another milestone was 2008, when Bush wanted Ukraine to join. And Mr. Putin very clearly had articulated his objection. And what happened that, well, Russia entered Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Then this 2014 Maidan uprising took place. And thereafter, Russia was left with no other choice than to go to Crimea and Donbas region. And since then, things have only been brewing up, and that has been coupled with economic sanctions, which is actually being very, very rude and very, very discriminatory towards Russia. So it's coupled up these factors and that deliberate attempt by America and Western countries to expand NATO, which has actually forced Russia to take recourse to this action.
Now, you mentioned Russia signaling its disagreement with Western strategy and even taking some forceful action, for example, in 2008. But I think without any doubt, the February decision was the most dramatic of all, not only for the world, but also for the Russians. Most of us were shocked that Russia is now using military force against our neighbor, and we still consider Ukrainians to be our brothers. I mean, in literal terms, because most of us have families there. If you were advising the Russian general staff, and I'm asking you not as a political analyst, but as a military man, as a man who has to consider, you know, strategic ramifications, do you think Russia had any other option at its disposal to, on the one hand, address the danger of encroachment of NATO, but on the other hand, without using military force? Because clearly there are major consequences associated with that, both ethically and humanitarily.
If I was there and somebody was really listening to me, then I would have perhaps advised some more restraint. There was a very strong three-pronged military posturing which Russia had already adopted. So we should have waited for some more time, because with 190,000 troops, 190,000 troops, it was very difficult for Ukrainian or any other force to enter Crimea or Donbass. Second issue, as a military analyst, I feel that Russia's initial strategy or maximalist strategy to go to Kyiv and sort of go to Kharkiv and these areas, this was probably not well thought through. And that is why, you know, the objectives were that you will be able to bring about a political capitulation and disarm Ukrainian armed forces by about 12th of March. But that did not come through, and then there was a repivot to the east Ukraine again. So that was avoidable. Some of those casualties were avoidable. The logistic support, the complementarity in the thrust line, the coordination, command, control, communication issues, they did not work out or pan out the way it should happen in a classic military campaign.
But you mentioned the classic military campaign, and over the last couple of years, all we've been hearing from the West and from the East is that the age of old wars, kinetic wars, is over. You know, all the wars will now be hybrid, information wars, perhaps some use of special forces, some use of espionage, perhaps false flag operations. But the real army against army clash is already a part of history. Don't you think that this latest development demonstrated that perhaps we have retired war prematurely? Because it seems to be a reality not only in Europe, but also an increasing reality now in the Pacific, when the United States and China seem to be at the loggerheads.
See, I think we had overplayed this irrelevance of classic campaigns. India has fought hybrid wars in Bangladesh. You also were preparing for a hybrid war, and what happened in Ukraine was a typical hybrid war right from 2014. So it has only validated the relevance and importance of hybrid war. Even today, the West is playing a proxy war in Ukraine. So this war is actually, the spectrum of conflict is much wider. It starts from the lower end in the non-contact, non-kinetic domain, then it goes up the escalation ladder across the spectrum of conflict to a full-fledged war, which we are seeing, with the risk of nuclear escalation. Suppose NATO would have intervened, then Russia had, you know, put its nuclear forces on operational readiness. So we cannot sort of totally take very short kind of observations and make very definite conclusions out of it.
As heart-wrenching as this war is, and it is indeed heart-wrenching for most Russians, I think it has demonstrated to the world that Russia has a credible deterrence, that it would use military force if it's vital interests are threatened. What about the quality of Western deterrence and the credibility of Western deterrence? Do you think the world believes that the Americans would resort to the use of military force as they claim?
See, deterrence is a mind game. So what we have seen earlier, what happened in Georgia, Americans did not intervene. Similarly, very recently, the way they withdrew from Afghanistan, and even their presence in Iraq has thinned down. And their leadership is on record to say that we will not physically intervene in Ukraine because we run the risk of, you know, escalating into the nuclear
factor. But they're also on record to say that we will physically intervene if there is an issue in Taiwan. So
no, see, Taiwan situation is very different. And again, you know, if you recall, when Mr. Biden made that statement, then the White House had resigned it from that statement, that what he meant was this, but not this. You know, so they're still following that strategic ambiguity in Taiwan contingency. But here they have taken a more strident position. But they will do everything except actually entering physically into Ukraine and further escalating the situation to an extent that Russia would be forced to up the ante.
Now, speaking about deterrence, I think it was President Theodore Roosevelt who defined it as speaking softly and carrying a big
long
stick. Yeah, but one century after his death, it seems that the Americans actually made the reverse, that they're not speaking softly, they're speaking obnoxiously, very rudely. But do you think their stick at this point of time is long enough to force their enemies or adversaries to do what they want, to do their bidding?
I may not entirely agree with your analysis, because you see, there is a great retrenchment which is taking place in United States. They have withdrawn from most of the countries, and Afghanistan is a case in point. That was the only toehold they had in Eurasia. So they've gone back, and now what they are doing, you know, they're trying to sort of offload most of their military responsibility to their NATO partners and put them in the front line. And that is why you would see when President Trump was there, he wanted NATO countries to have more share in the budget of NATO. And so those are the things. So I don't think Americans are in the same position to militarily intervene in various contingencies as it was in the past.
Major General, isn't that perhaps even more dangerous? Because if they were to take on the fight directly with the Russians, we could have negotiated directly and perhaps come to some sort of a solution. But when they are, using the Obama term, fighting from the back, that is pushing the Ukrainians on the front lines or pushing other peoples onto the front lines in that sort of a proxy battle, it also limits our ways of coming to some sort of a mutually agreeable solution. Doesn't that also jeopardize the prospects of peacemaking?
Absolutely correct. And this is what the gray zone and multi-domain warfare is all about, that it has blurred the lines between the classic military campaigns and peace. And this is an inaction, action, security, insecurity dilemma, which will persist. And therefore, at least in the foreseeable future, I do not see a way out in Ukraine conflict, because both sides have taken hardened position. And with the Finland and, say, Sweden, if they join NATO, they would have further upped the ante. So I don't see that. I think we are for a long haul, and this conflict is going to continue. Okay. And Russia will have to be prepared for that.
Okay, well, Major General, we have to take a very short break right now. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Ukraine will never be a victory for Russia.
Мы слышим сегодня, что мы начали войну на Донбассе, на Украине. Нет.
The Ukraine war is a proxy war. This is a war between Russia and the United States.
Ne zaman Amerikan silah şirketlerinin karnı doyarsa.
American forces are in Europe, not in Europe, to engage in conflict with Russian forces. The American forces are here to defend NATO allies.
What happens if NATO escalates even more? Then the special military operation become a war.
Кто бы ни пытался создать угрозы для нашего народа, должны знать, что ответ России приведет вас к таким последствиям, с которыми вы в своей истории еще никогда не сталкивались.
Цель операции – победить нацизм и победить Запад, потому что альтернативой является полная деструкция и уничтожение сегодняшней России как таковой.
Welcome Welcome back to Worlds Apart with BK Sharma, Major General of the Indian Armed Forces and Director of the United Service Institution of India. Major General, a few months ago, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said that today the world is facing an uncertain situation as nobody is getting what they want. And he made that statement specifically after talking with his American colleague Joe Biden on the phone. A conversation during which Joe Biden was trying to push India into joining the Western sanctions against Russia, and that push wasn't very successful. Why didn't India side with the Americans more promptly?
Oh, I mean, I would say, why should India sign with anybody?
Well, because Americans assume that
India is not America's team B. We are an independent country with the largest population. So we would make decisions based on our historical and strategic ties with other countries and based on our own national interest or strategic security interest. And in that, a country of the stature of Russia, who has helped India in its strategic programs and has been a reliable partner, how can, you know, India look the other way around and be extremely opportunistic? So we have taken our positions purely based on our principles and our multi-vector autonomous foreign policy.
You know, I'm interviewing a lot of non-Western speakers these days, and a lot of them are concerned about being caught in this economic and political crossfire between Russia and the West and being penalized for even taking a neutral position. Now, India is a large country. It's a very influential country. America wants it to be on its side. That's why there are certain accommodations towards your country. But my question to you is, do you think there's any player in this world today, perhaps India, who could take it upon itself to mediate between Russia and the West, given that you have very good ties with both sides and you and the rest of the world have a clear interest in making sure that the world is operational, that this conflict doesn't turn into yet another global war?
Precisely. That was the reason for India abstaining at number of these voting at the UN, because we wanted to maintain a neutral position and be available as an interlocutor between Russia and United States.
Are you available as an interlocutor? Mm-hmm. Are you interested in being that interlocutor?
Yes, we would do, but it will not happen overtly. Firstly, there were a lot of, you know, back doors or, you know, behind the curtain kind of diplomacy which will take place, which we are ready to pay. Turkey can do it, I mean, India is definitely in much better position to do it. So we would be very happy, as long as we are able to facilitate peace and end this conflict, we would be very happy to play that.
Mm-hmm. Now, as horrible, again, as this conflict is, there are also certain upsides, let's say, for various countries. And I know that over the last couple of months, Russia has come up from number 10 to number 4th as India's oil supplier. And many of the oil supplies that used to go to Europe are now going to India. I wonder if your country has any qualms about increasing its reliance on Russia's energy sources, as your European colleagues are so painfully trying to extricate themselves from that.
No, if we had any qualms, then despite the Western pressures, we wouldn't have been purchasing oil and gas from Russia.
Why are you not scared of this malevolent Russian energy?
Oh, because, you see, we are an energy deficient country. We require, for our economy, for the well-being of our people, we require cheap energy. And therefore, Russia is a reliable partner. So we have been able to utilize this window of opportunity despite the pressure from the West. And we would continue to do that.
Now, as you mentioned before, India is pursuing its own foreign policy, negotiating with the Americans and doing certain deals with the Americans. So is Russia increasing its cooperation with China? And I know that traditionally, India has looked at that with a certain degree of vigilance. You have a major border dispute with the Chinese. You also have security apprehensions about the growth of China. Have you seen any change in the Russian-Chinese dynamic over the last half a year? Do you think anything substantial has changed there?
See, one has to take a very realistic view of geopolitics. You share common borders with Russia. They are your immediate neighbors. We are still at a certain distance. And Chinese have very deep pockets. And I mean, post-2014, they were able to invest in your energy sector and many other places. So it is Russia's right to create that complementarity and interdependence. So Russia, India does not dictate to other countries how, what kind of relations it should have with its own neighbors. So we have no such qualms. Our relations with Russia are on its own merit, and it would continue to be. And we are also aware that Russia would not undermine India's strategic interests just because they become economically close to China.
And that's actually a very interesting question. How sensitive, according to your sources, is Russia to India's security concerns? Does Russia make accommodation for India's position, let's say, more than it would be paying attention to other countries?
Of course, it has. The kind of weapon system that you have provided us is very, very exclusive. You have not provided that kind of weapon system to any other country. Of course, very recently, you upgraded your military relations with China. And even when we had problem with Chinese on the line of actual control, Russian met all its contractual obligations and was to the extent of, you know, giving us more and more weapons that we needed. Now, these are hard times when you test the depth of a relationship. And Russia has come, risen to the occasion and met Indian expectations and would continue to do so.
Speaking about the depth of the relationship as well as military cooperation, as we are recording this interview, the Russians and the Chinese are conducting their traditional Navy drills. And one of the things that I heard from Russian military analysts is that while China has a very impressive Navy, both in terms of human capacity, in terms of their ships, they lack in the experience and expertise of the actual warfare, and that this is something that the Russians may be sharing with their Chinese neighbors. If that were the case, would that be a concern for India?
You see, if you train Chinese Navy, PLA Navy, it is not of any concern. You have a relationship with us. Indian Navy is very strong, and our sphere of influence is into the Indian Ocean region. And by virtue of our strategic geography, we have a very good domination there. We are interested in getting out of into South China Sea, but it's purely from the point of view that 60% of our trade passes through that. And we want freedom of navigation, but you would see that we have not joined freedom of navigation exercises with the Americans or anybody. So I think our Navy is very, very, very professional. It's very well trained, and it can secure India's national interests in the Indian Ocean region, and we would be satisfied with that.
You mentioned geography, and I think one of the interesting features of the increasing cooperation between Russia and China, and also, you know, I think a sign of trust in a way, is that both Russia and China can afford to expand less on guarding their own border, which is not a small thing because it's for more than 4,000 kilometers long. And essentially, Russia can now divert its attention to the West. China can deal with its problems in the Pacific, and the two are essentially standing back to back. I don't know how long it will historically last, and that's why I wanted to ask you, do you think this current level of trust, when you can turn your back to, you know, a country with which we also had border disputes in the past, do you think it's primarily necessitated by the difficulties with the West, or it can sustain itself historically?
Well, this is a big question, and this all depends on how you manage your bilateral relations with China. In the past, you had problems in Central Asia, right? In future also, no country would like to see another country with a large military next door. And particularly if that country turns to be revisionist and it wants to alter the geography. These concerns must...
You think that's a real prospect, though, on the part of Chinese? Because they claim that they have no such intentions.
What Chinese have done in South China Sea, the what you call is the 1949 claim line, or what they have done elsewhere, even on the Indian borders. Well, it does give you certain indications that, well, Their cartographic consciousness is very high.
But do you think it's the same, the shift in the land map and the shifts in the maritime maps?
No, no. Since you have resolved your border issues with China, the influence doesn't come purely in military terms. It is in the economic sphere of influence. You see, look at Central Asia, where you had such a good clout and such a good influence. Today, Chinese economic engagement is more than $50 billion. I think yours would be to the tune of $20 to $30 billion. So the economic influence can result into the political influence. And the countries of your neighbors, your neighboring countries will make political choices which are more in congruence with Chinese strategic interests vis-a-vis Russian interests. You look at Belt and Road Initiative, right? It's the Chinese who are calling the shots, and, well, it is integrating economies. So these are the new forms of influences and not the military influence, which are more pertinent in today's world.
But is it really so competitive as you seem to be suggesting? Because I assume that the current level of cooperation between Russia and China would also allow China, or Russia for that matter, to take their sensitive issues into account.
I'm of the view that if the West had not imposed economic sanctions against Russia in 2014, probably the trajectory of Russia-China relations would have been very different today.
Okay. Can I also ask you about the trajectory of the Chinese-Indian relationship? Because it's hard to imagine the other two pair of countries which would benefit more from, you know, their synergies, from combining their forces. But you have a border dispute, as we mentioned, and there is a general climate of suspicion there. What keeps this dynamic of mistrust so entrenched? And is it possible to overcome it in time?
India tried its level best to have very harmonious relations with China. From 1993 till 2013, we signed a series of agreements for peace, building peace and tranquility on the border and on the use of force. When India was going through a complicated COVID situation, the Chinese, they violated all those agreements and they used military force to change the status quo at the line of actual control. Now, what does India make out of it? Well, that means that, well, they do not want peace and they want probably peace on their own terms, that they want a China-centric Asia in which they feel India is a big competitor. And it is good time to put India in its place. But given the size of India and the confidence that we hold, we would not permit any country under the sun to strategically coerce us. And that is why, you know, we've taken recourse to military responses, which China has understood. And hopefully, with these lessons, it will have a sobering effect on Chinese to negotiate with us from a position of parity.
What I'm hearing from you is that the Chinese need to revision some of the wisdoms of Sun Tzu, who actually argued for mutual accommodation rather than zero-sum outcomes. Anyway, Major General, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.